It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up 13 years after the 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, we'll look at the state of terrorism around the world.
First, we're continuing our series On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. All week, we've been examining different aspects of Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. On Monday, we learned about the history of alcohol use in Wisconsin and what the state's drinking habit costs us.
On Tuesday, we talked to a doctor about how alcohol affects the body and learned about some new treatment initiatives for alcoholics. Yesterday, we spoke to someone from the Winnebago County Health Department about an alternative program there for multiple OWI offenders. And you can check out all those interviews at WPR.org.
Today, we're hearing about the personal side of alcoholism and recovery. Our guest was convicted of 7 drinking and driving offenses, or OWIs, before she decided to quit using alcohol once and for all. Paula Perrin is with us now to share her story. She's a recovering alcoholic. Paula, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you.
Paula, when did you first start drinking?
When I was 12 years old.
So that's pretty young. Looking back, is there a reason why you started drinking when you were only 12?
I was hanging out with kids that were older than me, for one. My mom actually is a recovering alcoholic as well, and she actually quit drinking at that time. I think that part of it was I was so used to chaos in my life that once things started to get normal, it was just common for me to make, a mess of things again.
So it's hard to imagine having access to alcohol when you're only 12. How did you get a hold of it?
Like I said, I hung out with people that were older than me, who had brothers and sisters that were older than them, or their boyfriends or whatever. So it really wasn't that hard to get a hold of.
And you were convicted ultimately of 7 OWI offenses. Why did you keep drinking and driving? Why did it keep repeating itself, that cycle?
Honestly, I think I struggled for many years actually believing that I had a problem. I think a lot of it is our culture. I mean, it's so hard to realize there's a problem because there's so many people doing it. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has a problem, but I mean, in my own personal, obviously I did. But I struggled. There was a part of it where I was on probation and I stayed sober for about 3 years off and on. And I think once I was done with probation, there was something inside my head that said, well, maybe it was because I was on probation that I kept getting in trouble. So I decided to venture out and start drinking again. And it was within a year that I got the 7th offense.
And so you said that you think part of it was that it's just acceptable. Did you, looking back at the town, the people you were friends with, your social life, the atmosphere, can you pinpoint the things that made it seem like it wasn't that outside of the norm for you to be drinking and driving so often?
I think that I actually hung out with a lot of people that drank a lot. And honestly, I think I did it purposely just so it would be accepted. Even like when I was sober for a while, and this is prior times of being sober, I would be okay and hang out with people that didn't drink, people from AA. And when things started going wrong in my life with relationships or whatever, I seriously would look for people that I know would be okay with me drinking.
So something wasn't working for you in staying sober between those OWIs. What was it that kept pulling you back in to drinking all those times that you had gotten sober for a while, for 3 years at a time?
I never fixed the core problem. It wasn't until I had my 7th DUI and actually went to the Earned Release Program and went into treatment that I actually started looking at, all the events surrounding when I would get really bad in my drinking and around, the times of my drunk drivings. And when I started doing research, I mean, it seriously was surrounding relationships. That was my huge, huge problem. And life in general, I had no coping skills whatsoever. The only way I knew how to handle things was to numb it.
Were you a parent at the time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you were drinking and driving, and you were trying to raise kids, and it sounds like that was all kind of wound up together, the fact that you were dealing with relationship troubles and raising children.
True, yes. And, you know, and I know that a lot of my habits fell onto them, you know, and I know that some of the things that they did as they got older were things that I taught them. And, you know, looking back now, I wish I would have, you know, but I didn't know any different at that point.
Well, your story obviously has a turning point, and you were convicted of your 7th OWI offense, and then you were put in a treatment program. What happened then? How did that program change things for you?
Well, first of all, the program was 6 months long, and it was literally 24/7. It's really kind of hard to fake your way through that. So you really have to look at everything, every aspect of your life on, you know, why you drank, you know, why you did everything, and how you handled life. And basically, for me, going into the program, you know, I kept telling everybody, yes, I'm done with drinking. This is my 7th drunk driving. I'm done. But honestly, at the very beginning, I don't necessarily think I believed that completely yet. When I first went into treatment, the supervisor there actually asked us, there were 10 of us in our group, and he asked us, you know, what's the one thing that would ever make you go back out there? And 9 out of 10 of us said if something happened to our kids. That 10th person didn't have kids yet. He kind of explained to us that, you know, that's basically just like the snake in the bush waiting to attack. There's always going to be something out there that's going to pull you back in. And, you know, at first, I don't think that I really, really, truly understood that. But as time went through, you know, with my treatment, you know, and I actually started digging into all of my character defects and trying to figure out that it's okay to just be me. Because for years I always worried about what everybody else thought of me. And I think a lot of people do, you know, obviously I had a lot of self-esteem issues. And I truly just did not know how to handle life in general. Any misfortune whatsoever that came into my life, I chose to run away from it. You know, I tried the relocating, you know, and it would be okay for a little while, but there was always that problem inside that followed me because I never fixed it. As time went on in treatment, though, you know, I was starting to basically dissect everything about me and actually try to find coping skills and, you know, figure out how to just let life be and, you know, accept things that, you know, I could change and accept things that I couldn't change. But I had, you know, obviously know which ones were which. But as the time went on, actually about 2 weeks prior to my graduating of the Earned Release Program, I think that even at that point, there was still something inside me that wasn't really sure that I was done. And then I had something really bad happen in my life, and it was my son. My oldest son actually committed suicide.
I'm so
during
sorry.
That time, within, I think, probably the first 2 hours, I had talked to my sister, and she was telling me that my middle son actually said, great, now Mom has a reason to drink, and I wouldn't blame her. Honestly, I think that's where it really clicked. I called him immediately, and I said, you know what? I said, I've changed. That's the last thing you have to worry about. You know, I wasn't able to actually go to my son's funeral or his wake. I got a very short personal visitation with him. You know, When it first happened, they actually were trying to get me released right away, because once I was done with the program, I was actually, you know, going to be released anyways. But unfortunately, the warden at the prison decided that she didn't want to risk me relapsing. And, you know, at first I was like, well, what's the difference if I relapse now or if I relapse in 2 weeks when I get out, you know? And it was actually my son, my middle son, that made me really think, you know, I was surrounded by people that knew how to help me cope with all of that. You know, had I gone home at that point and actually been able to go to the funeral, honestly, I don't know if I would have been able to handle it. So in a way, it was almost like it's what should have been. You know, I went to have the visitation with my son, and I got to go home, and or not home, but I got to go back and actually be surrounded with people that, you know, really knew how to get me through what I was going through. Within the first hour of hearing of my son's suicide, the doctors there actually asked me if I wanted sleeping pills or depression pills or anything to help me cope with it. And right then it was like, you know what, no, because if I would have done that, it would have just been a new form in a different bottle.
You went
and
through
so much.
Yeah, you could have.
I knew I needed to feel this. I had to feel this pain or there was no way I was going to be able to deal with anything else.
Paula, thank you so much for being willing to share this. I know it's incredibly painful, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your son. And in sharing this today, I'm hoping that we'll bring lots of people into the conversation who might be going through similar things, might be dealing with loss and heartache and pain and looking for a way out. So I thank you for that. We're talking with Paula Perrin now about her story of alcoholism and recovery as part of our series On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture.
Paula stays with us, and we'd like to hear your personal story, too. How has alcohol touched your life? Have you experienced alcoholism yourself or maybe in a loved one or a close friend? How did it change your relationship? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're continuing our conversation now with recovering alcoholic Paula Perrin about how alcohol abuse affected her life.
And we want to hear your stories, too. Are you an alcoholic or in recovery? How did alcoholism change your life or maybe affect your relationships? If someone close to you experienced alcoholism, how did it affect you, your relationship with them? Share your stories now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
Paula, a couple moments ago, you told us how your son's suicide was a turning point for you in your sobriety. You said that there was always a part of you that thought maybe you weren't sober for good, but that is as a mother, what did the trick for you. Looking back now from where you are, is it difficult to stay sober today?
Honestly, no. For me right now, my whole mindset has changed. The way I look at things now, I made it through the worst event possible without drinking. Today, if I were to even drink just because I wanted to, I look at that as a complete disrespect to my son. You know, he has a little boy that is 4 years old now, and I want him to know that you don't have to turn to alcohol to solve life's problems. I want him to know that there's other ways to deal with life.
You're setting a new example for your grandchildren.
Exactly.
And what if someone's listening now and they haven't gone through that life earthquake that you went through losing your son? They want to be sober, but maybe they feel a little bit like you did before, like they haven't completed the journey, they're not sure. What would you say to them?
Honestly, I think that they need to take a look at all the events throughout their life. You know, when did the drinking spike? What was going on in their life at that time? You know, just basically do it kind of like a timeline of their life. And, you know, whenever it escalated, what was going on and why weren't you able to deal with it? You know, because that's, for me, that was the key factor of actually making me look at my character defects. And basically, don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, people aren't going to judge you. Honestly, it takes a lot of courage to admit that you have a problem. And it takes a lot of courage to actually work on fixing it.
We have a caller now I want to bring into our conversation. JJ is joining us in Fond du Lac. Hi, JJ.
Hi there. Well, just about 26 years ago, I got into recovery, and it was, quote, on my own, unquote, just meaning that my life had really spiraled, you know, so out of control that I'd lost myself. I was doing things that I did not want to do at all. And I had, I think, a big blessing. I had an experience that made me decide to go to AA. And for the first time in my life, I didn't talk myself out of it because I had done that a number of times before. And all I can say is that it has been such an incredible journey, very, very hard a lot of times. But the change in me and in my family and everything about my life is, you know, so worth it.
JJ, thank you so much for sharing that. And you're talking again about what Paul is talking. You have this change in yourself and it radiates out to everybody around you. Paul, is that part of the big payoff? Part of being sober is for you, but part of being sober is for everyone around you, those people that you love.
Correct. You know, I think throughout my drinking, I was always looking for something and I didn't realize I already had it. You know, looking for somebody to accept me. You know, my kids accept me, you know, regardless of what I've done in my past, they don't judge me. And I think it's important for people to really take a look at what they really have in their lives and actually, you know, appreciate it.
You are sober now, and even though you have your sobriety as a gift, you still live in Wisconsin. You still live in a state where there tends to be, as we've been hearing in the series, a more permissive attitude toward drinking and alcohol, maybe even drinking and driving. Does that make it more difficult to stay sober? Or do you think now that you've sort of walked through this fire that it doesn't matter as much?
Honestly, I have not had any problems at all staying sober this time. But like I said, you know, I changed my entire mindset on everything. Alcohol is no longer an option for me. Before, it used to be. You know, there was always something that was going to draw me back. The last time that I relapsed, it was, again, a relationship problem. I relocated, and I went to an area where I knew there was people that would be okay with me drinking. You know, and for a long time, that's who I blamed it on. I blamed it on the people I was hanging around. And, you know, today I know that it wasn't them. It was me. I allowed myself to relapse. And today I know that I don't ever want to relapse again. And the only way to keep that is to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, I'm speaking at treatment centers. I've actually spoken at Robert E. Ellsworth. And I share my story to remind myself of why I stay sober.
And if someone's listening out there right now who's struggling with alcohol, isn't where you are, I should say, what would you tell them about how to go forward, how to take a first step?
Pick up the phone. Don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, you can go online and find a meeting absolutely anywhere. You know, and if you go to a one meeting and you don't feel like it's for you, try another one. You know, right now I actually have a meeting that is an hour and 15 minutes away from me. But I get so much from that meeting that I don't care. You know, I look at my past on my drinking. It was nothing for me to drive an hour away to go drinking somewhere. You know, if I wanted to hide it from my family that I was drinking or whatever. So if I was willing to do that to drink, why wouldn't I be willing to do that to stay sober?
Well, Paula, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your story.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was recovering alcoholic Paula Perrin. She was joining us for our series On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we mark the 13th anniversary of the 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, questions about national security and terrorist threats in the Middle East are dominating headlines.
Last night, on the eve of the anniversary, President Obama addressed the threat posed by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria and referred to as ISIS or ISIL. He laid out his approach for combating the threat the group may pose around the world.
As the U.S. launches into a more dedicated offensive against ISIS and marks the September 11th attacks, we're taking the opportunity to look at terrorist threats posed around the world today and how the United States has responded to them over the last 13 years, from Afghanistan to places like Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and Nigeria.
Here with us is Stephen Vladek, professor of law at American University Washington College of Law. He's the editor-in-chief of the National Security Forum, Just Security. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So more than a decade after September 11th, which group or groups do you see as posing the biggest threat to the U.S. in terms of interest and security today?
Well, I mean, it certainly sounds from everything we've heard from the Obama administration like the real threat we face today comes from ISIL, from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And that's partly because ISIL is in a position not just to threaten Americans overseas, but to really threaten American interests in Iraq, to wreak havoc in Syria, to pose a major humanitarian threat to religious minorities. So, so far as we can tell from what's public, it really does seem like ISIL is the biggest threat the U.S. faces today.
Now, Americans are very familiar with the name al-Qaeda by now. ISIL or ISIS seems to have sort of mushroomed overnight. Is ISIS a group that has sort of evolved from al-Qaeda, or is it a separate entity?
I think that's the million-dollar question. It's certainly true, based on what we know, that ISIS at least started as part of al-Qaeda, that ISIS was initially aligned with al-Qaeda, that they had similar goals, especially in the early years of the insurgency in Iraq. But it's also clear that at some point there was a real split, there was a real divide between senior members of ISIS and senior members of al-Qaeda. And, the real question legally is, what are the consequences of that split? What are the consequences of that divide? Because Congress in the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, passed 1 week after 9/11, clearly authorized force against al-Qaeda insofar as al-Qaeda was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Whether it authorized force against al-Qaeda's successor groups really depends on whether groups like ISIS are, in fact, al-Qaeda's successors or more like their, stilted ex-girlfriend.
Well, they seem to be competitive now. I think it was a week or two ago we had an example of al-Qaeda announcing that they were launching a branch in India, in the subcontinent at least, and that was seen as a move to upstage ISIS. So are the two groups at least in competition and distinct now?
I mean, I guess if it's a competition, it's one with the likes of which we've never seen before. And I think the real difficulty for us, for Americans right now, is to separate out the legal question, which is whether President Obama has the authority to use military force against ISIS, from the practical question, which is, shouldn't we have Congress more directly confronting the nature of the threat today as opposed to the nature of the threat we faced 13 years ago this week? And I think the split and the chasm between the legal analysis and the policy analysis is really what's causing so much of the problems in Washington right now.
Terrorism in general has really emerged since September 11th as a defining worry of our time in terms of global security. Are there a larger variety of terrorist organizations now than there were in 2001?
I mean, I think there certainly has been a proliferation of, multinational terrorist groups over the last 13 years. But, the important thing for everyone to remember is that Congress never actually declared war against terrorism. It was a common rhetorical trope during the Bush administration to refer to the war on terror, but Congress was actually much more specific. Congress was worried about the groups that hit us on 9/11 because those were the groups who we thought faced the biggest threat to the United States. Those were the groups where we weren't sure that our existing self-defense and law enforcement authorities would be adequate. So, whatever the nature of international terrorism today, The real question for the American people, the real question for Congress, is what is the nature of the threat the U.S. specifically faces today? And I think that's why so much of our attention in the recent weeks and months has been shifting away from al-Qaeda, which is really a shadow of its former self, and toward ISIS.
If we agree, which, as you're saying, we don't, there's no consensus right now, but if it emerges that we see ISIS as an outgrowth of al-Qaeda, does that mean that the president is within his bounds in his actions?
I mean, I think the reality is there's a legal case to be made that insofar as ISIS really is the successor to al-Qaeda, insofar as ISIS is basically the derivative, then yes, there is a plausible argument that the statute Congress passed in September 2001 to allow the president to go after al-Qaeda also allows the president to go after its heirs and its successors. The problem is that that's only a legal argument. As a matter of common sense and just good practice, I think it would behoove everyone. It would behoove Congress, it would behoove the president, it would behoove all of us to have Congress passing a statute that's much more specifically tailored to the case at hand. Because whether or not you can pigeonhole and shoehorn ISIS into the 9/11 AUMF, there's no question that Congress wasn't thinking about ISIS back then. And so the better step going forward, the better policy going forward, would be a more specific statute that was based on the threat we face today, as opposed to the threat we faced 13 years ago.
Last night, President Obama held up Somalia and Yemen as examples of the kind of involvement the United States will have when it tries to combat ISIS. What kind of counterterrorism efforts have we seen there that could be applicable going forward?
Yeah, the Somalia and Yemen examples are interesting ones for the president to have invoked, because in both of those countries, what we've seen is scattershot uses of military force by the U.S., whether it comes in the form of drone strikes against targeted leaders, whether it comes in the form of special operations missions to actually go into the territory of those countries to capture high-level suspects. The military force we've used has been more like a scalpel than like a broadsword. And so if that's the plan, if that's President Obama's vision of the force he's contemplating to use against ISIS, then it is, I think, going to look a lot different from the original mission in Iraq a decade ago, where we had, over 100,000 combat troops on the ground. That doesn't seem to be where we're going. That doesn't necessarily mean that everything that the president is proposing falls within the scope of the same authority. But it does mean we're talking about much more limited military force than what was true, for example, in Iraq in 2002 and 2003.
Do you have a sense where terrorist operations stand today in places like Pakistan and Nigeria?
Yeah, we are seeing upsurges in isolated acts of terrorism in Pakistan and Nigeria, in a number of countries around the world. And I think the real question that's going to keep the Obama administration up at night is whether the way to mitigate the threat to the United States is to actually become much more aggressive in policing even those threats, to basically take up the mantle of the world's terrorism police, or to try to figure out alternative methods for helping those governments, helping those regimes become more stable, become more self-sufficient, and become more able to deter and prevent terrorism on their own soil. And I have to think that in the long term, we are all better off the less that the U.S. is responsible for preventing and deterring terrorism all over the world.
Well, President Obama has said that he's trying to engage allies in this. That's part of what he spoke about last night. And when it comes to U.S. military action combating terrorism, he has been in that sort of arena more cautious. With ISIS, it seems as though, especially the last week or two, his feet have really been held to the fire to act. So what is it about ISIS that is putting this pressure on the president?
I mean, I think realistically, what is the game changer for ISIS is the degree to which they control large amounts of territory and large amounts of land in both Syria and Iraq. Because when we're talking about other groups like Boko Haram in Nigeria or Jamaat Islamiyah in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, we're talking about groups that have a presence, but that don't control territory. And with territory comes the ability to launch far more aggressive operations and the ability to have much more success in staging attacks on surrounding countries than when you have terrorist groups operating within the borders of, wholly functioning civil government. So I think the real problem in ISIS's case is not just their ideology and their agenda. It's also the topography and the geography of their control, which gives them so much more power and so much more maneuverability than so many of the other terrorist groups that you hear about on a daily basis.
So that's interesting. You're saying it's topography and control of land and not so much the violence that we've seen.
I mean, I think the reality is it's hard to rank terrorist groups on the scale of the violence to which they, you know, would like to. It's very hard to rank terrorist groups on a sort of a violent scale. I think the real question is, how can you deter the threat? And when you have terrorist groups that are operating, you know, within countries that have completely functioning civil governments, that have control over all their territory, usually the best way to deal with that threat is through ordinary law enforcement capacities, because presumably that country has the ability, perhaps with some outside support, to go and arrest the suspects. When you have terrorist groups that control their own territory, that option goes totally out the window. And so it really becomes a question of other countries using military force on the soil of a third-party country to try to prevent that threat. That's what's new about ISIS, and from the Obama administration's perspective, that is what's so deeply problematic, at least diplomatically.
Last night, President Obama said that he would combat ISIL or ISIS wherever in the world that they are. And ISIS is a terrorist group that calls itself an Islamic State. So if that idea of Islamic statehood appeals to other terrorist groups elsewhere in the world, does that mean that the U.S. has authority to go after them wherever they are?
No, I mean, I think as a matter of law, the legal authority only runs to the groups that were responsible for attacking us on September 11th and their successors. And so that means al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and insofar as it's true, and query whether it is true, perhaps ISIS as a successor to al-Qaeda. You know, if there are other groups around the world that have similar violent extremist ideologies and that take up the mantle of Islam, that doesn't qualify them for being targeted. I mean, and that's, I think, the key point here that many members of Congress keep forgetting. This is not a war against Islamist extremism. This is not a war against religious terrorism. This is a war against specific groups that have a specific connection to the worst terrorist attacks in world history.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Steve Vladek, professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, looking at the state of terrorism around the world as we mark September 11th.
Coming up in this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we meet two members of Wisconsin Pinball League who want to bring the game back to its past glory.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Not too long ago, you couldn't be in a bowling alley or pizza shop or an episode of Sesame Street, where this music is from, without hearing the electromechanical sounds of the pinball machine.
They're getting harder to find these days, but there is a growing niche of pinball purists out there who still want to be pinball wizards.
Today in our Curious Wisconsin segment, we talked to Tim Enders and Steve Tully. They are pinball enthusiasts, and they're members of the Mad City Flippers Pinball League. Tim, Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice
Thanks
to be here.
Well, Tim, let's start with you. What is it about pinball that generates such a passion for you guys?
I've been just doing it since I was a kid, inspired by my brother a little bit, and just, you know, being down at the shops by West High School, started playing Flash and just got really interested in it.
Flash was your first machine. Steve,
yeah.
What was yours?
Of Mills Cannon Fire, it was a flipperless pre-war one that my aunt and uncle had in their basement when
no
I was a
kidding.
Kid. Yeah.
No flippers, so what do you do?
You just nudge it and hope for the best.
Okay, my first memory was Evel Knievel pinball machine. Evel Knievel was the superstar of the 70s, and of course, he had a pinball machine named after him. I was never very good at it, though. So Steve, with that pre-war one, what's the history of these machines? Where did the pinball machine come from?
Late 1800s, I guess. They started with basically like a billiards, a board lying flat with pins on it, and they'd shoot a ball there and have it bounce back and forth and have it land in a certain spot, and you'd add the score up by hand, you know.
So it's like horizontal pachinko, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually, as electronics evolved, they started putting switches and relays and score reels on it, and now it's computer controlled with all kinds of bells and whistles on it.
So, Tim, we've got, I didn't know this, pinball leagues and tournaments going around here in the state.
Correct. Actually, this weekend, Mad Rollin' Pinballs will be this Saturday at Pooley's, which we actually have a monthly tournament over there as well, where anyone's welcome, and we encourage it.
Now, can you tell watching someone play the serious player versus the, yo, pinball, cool, I'll give it a try? Steve?
Yeah, sort of. There's a certain intensity to the better players, and But you never know. An amateur can get on a roll, too, and keep it in play and shoot the flashing lights and keep it in play as long as you can.
Now, that's the key. Now, I think of pinball as largely a game of chance, the way I play it. And, you know, yeah, I can do the flippers, and I'll catch the ball and wait and, like, pick my shot, and I can do that a little.
Nice.
But what about, you know, nudging it and controlling the ball without tilting the machine and shutting down that round?
There's definitely an art to it. You know, certain machines are set a lot lighter than other machines. It depends. In tournaments, for instance, they're definitely the tilt is set a lot lighter, where if you shake the machine, bump it a little too much, or the continuum of that, you know, you run the risk of tilting.
So it's in tournaments, it's harder to get away with nudging, you're saying?
Definitely. And you have open lanes where they pull out posts, and it's typically a lot faster game.
Wow. Okay. So, of course, we see fewer and fewer pinball machines out there. You see them all over at arcades. Now it's kind of a retro thing. So, Steve, as a pinball guy, where do you go? How do you find machines still in service?
On the internet, there's maps. What do I want to say? There's... You can search for where pinballs are on, like,
Pinside.
Pinside. Yep. There's a website. Pinball Rebel has a pinball locator, and it goes worldwide. You can find bars and bowling alleys and places like that that have pinball machines, and start from there. Find out when the tournaments are. IFPAPinball.com is an international flipper pinball association. They have a calendar of different tournaments worldwide. And statewide.
And I've been to places that really specialize in retro, in some cases video games, and pinball machines. And they're, I mean, it's mechanical and electronic genius keeping these things aligned. Have you guys ever gone under the hood on these, either of you?
Both?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you do, Steve?
You kind of have to. It's definitely a hobby thing if you want to keep it running well. You have to learn how they work. And it's an electronic thing, kind of like a car guy or train. Model railroad, you know, you have to kind of learn how they work. And there's a lot of help on the internet and through our pinball league and stuff like that. There's a lot of help there and the chat groups and things like that.
And is there a lot of trading of parts and things like that? Like, I need a Fetzer valve for my machine?
Absolutely. I mean, my brother, for instance, has a real big collection of parts. He's definitely a great repairman. So I think a lot of people are knocking on his door. So.
Well, I want to talk about some of the great machines. I mentioned Evel Knievel. My favorite series was Cabby, Pinbot, and Bride of Pinbot. I told you guys
Taxi.
This.
Taxi is the Cabby right. One you're talking about.
Hey,
yep.
Cabby, the yell, Gorbachev yells on
yep.
That. So, and you, I said those, and you're like, and you named the designer. Who?
Yep. So, Python Angelo on the Pinbot, yeah. And then Mark Ritchie on Taxi, and then what was the other one you named?
Bride of Pinbot, and Taxi.
Okay, yeah. Sure, yep.
So, and this amazed me, you guys know the designers of the pinball machines.
Yeah, and some of them you just kind of get to learn that stuff through being immersed in the hobby.
Have you met any of the legends of the game who have designed some of these?
Absolutely.
Yeah, at Pinball Expo, they do it every October down in Chicago. They usually, that's where pinball is. Basically, that was where a lot of them were built, and Stern's still in business. And they have a Pinball Expo every October, and a lot of the designers come and hang out, and they have an autograph session. But, you know, they're passing through looking at their machines and stuff like that.
So I said my favorite's Tim. What's yours of all time?
Well, I would go between Twilight Zone, Circus Voltaire, and my newest machine, Metallica. So I love the band.
And so that'll play bits of Enter Sandman or whatever while
exactly,
you're playing.
Exactly, exactly right.
Or maybe more hardcore
yep,
songs.
Yep, Battery, so. And anything you can think of. I mean, it's great. And Tully has Rolling Stones himself, so...
Okay, and Steve?
Yeah, they've got a Rolling Stones game I really like. And Adam's Family is a go-to favorite. I've got a couple older ones. And, you know, favorites kind of come and go. You'll tire of one after a while. And then I've got about a dozen in the collection. And, you know, you'll play the heck out of one for a while. And then it'll rest. And then all of a sudden you'll go back to it. And...
Now, there have been computer game simulations of pinball machines. Heresy, or is that something worth playing, Steve?
I don't really play them, but I've seen them, and you know, it's amazing how realistic they're getting. Mm-hmm. And it's good to practice and learn the rules.
And the physics. And Tim, yes. Where do you see the future of pinball in this video game tablet age?
I think it's good for learning the rule sets, definitely. But you're never going to get the feel that you do with an actual pinball, because it's actually real life with the steel ball. But you can learn a lot of the rule sets.
Are we nearing a pinball renaissance? Is there a critical mass where people are making the machines and playing enough to bring it back and see them in more places?
I think so, because a lot of the video games are dying, I feel, on location, because you can play them on your smartphone, but pinball is pretty difficult to replicate on a video screen.
You got a tournament coming up, either of you guys?
Mad Rollin' Pinballs this Saturday. And you can go there. It's for cancer, and you can play a side tournament. The tournament itself is full, but you can play a side tournament, so we encourage that.
Great. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Honored being here.
And Tim, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
That's Tim Enders and Steve Tully, pinball fans, pinball players. They are members of the Mad City Flippers Pinball League.
If you want to be a guest on Curious Wisconsin and tell us about your story, or if you want to nominate someone else, call our hotline. It's 855-683-5422 or email centraltime@wpr.org.